Thank you, Andy. It's just always the 60s somewhere, isn't it? It's 5 o'clock somewhere, it's the 60s somewhere. It happens to be here. Okay, so last week I was here. I gave a perfectly fine little talk. It wasn't earth-shattering, but it was okay, on inherent conflict and, you know, how the ways that we work those out, better or worse, leads us to sometimes present worse parts of ourselves rather than the better parts. It all went okay. We went to talk back. People found out I was going to talk about higher education. No one asked me a single question about the talk I gave last week. It was all about higher education. Fine. That's how you want to go. That's what we'll do. So I'm back to talk about higher education and the university. There still will be talk back, and we're going to have some people help us out with that. So again, my eldest daughter, Sonia, who just started at Grand Valley, is here. And then we're also going to highlight a graduating senior this year, Victoria, or Tori Arrow, who's sitting here in the front, along with being a neuropsych major, and she's on her way to go do a PhD. She also is a research assistant for the CUSI Business Ethics Initiative, where she does a fantastic job. So I'm going to talk for 15 minutes, just highlight a few things. Mandy is going to take her scarf, yank me off the stage. Tori's going to come up, speak for 5 minutes or so, and then we're going to do something. We'll see how it goes. We have to be on the same page on this. I actually would like to open it up to questions in the main talk and spend about 10 minutes. Because there was so much interest in this and so much conversation, there's only one real rule about that I'm sure you already know what it is. You do have to be succinct, okay? And phrase your question as a question. That would be also good. All right. Let me start one by one, the university and AI. You all know we're under an awful lot of pressures, an awful lot of threat from within and from without. AI is changing everything, no doubt about that. Let me start with a story that tells you maybe the degree to which it's going to change that a lot of folks aren't talking about. It comes both from a conference that I was at a year and a half ago in Paris. Somebody had to go. a growing number of books, Mohamed Suleiman, especially his book, The Coming Wave, which I've recommended here before, where the real threat, if you like, or challenge or opportunity, the thing to keep your eye on, is not so much just technology and AI as built into computer systems. It really is biotechnology. That's the one that people aren't talking about probably as much as they should be. And I'll give you one example. We're at this conference. About 60% of us are faculty from universities around the world. Other 40% tech folks from mostly California, but other places in the world as well. We're all kind of doing our thing, expressing our, we don't know what to do about AI. How's this going to affect teaching? How do we incorporate it? Should we incorporate it? Right? A lot of smart questions, no good answers. Tech people couldn't be more self-assured, couldn't be more confident. And the one that sticks in my mind the most is a woman probably in her 50s who represented one of the larger tech companies you would be familiar with, who got up after everything else was said, really, don't worry. I mean, in that kind of, you know, right out of George Orwell. Don't worry. Why? Why shouldn't we worry? Because while your kids, my kid who's 18, will not, for the most part, be wearing the Google glasses, the next generation will, as AI becomes more seamlessly incorporated into their world. But beyond that, the next generation, as AI becomes even more seamlessly interwoven into their world, are going to be very comfortable with the chip. And we all just went, all right, we see where this is coming. And as if it were a fait accompli, with no real reservations, she just went on to explain that the technology is pretty much already present. The brain-computer interface is ready to go. People will be chipped. And why wouldn't they want to be? Because we've got it down from several devices, pretty much down to one, a phone and or computer. But by this generation that's in elementary school now, no devices at all. Hands-free, Mom. It's all chipped. Now, of course, there are folks who wonder if that technology has really progressed to that point. Let me assure you that there are many, many people who think it has or are supremely confident that it will. By that point, it really is our reluctance to be embedded as it were, or to have things embedded that's holding us back, isn't that a shame? And they were kind of, her and others, she and others, were they were both sort of going through a litany of things that were going to be great because of the technology that would take things more and more off our plates. Well, as professors, you'll now be free to do well, and then somebody else would come and that thing would be taken off. So it was a little like watching a parade of tech bros happily reading our obituary. You know? You know, and by the way, we're not really going to miss you. So that's one. AI and animosity. The animosity is coming from many quarters. It has come from within, certainly, rigid ideological, what probably most of you are familiar with as woke or cancel culture. Some of this we're doing to ourselves. So those of you who, your question would be, to what extent has the university imploded because of its own internecine, its own inability to get its house in order, its inability to govern itself well, a significant percentage of that. Some of the adults have left the building. The most, maybe one of the greatest examples of that to me was when the presidents of Harvard and Columbia and I'm forgetting the other one were called in front of Congress and just didn't seem to be able to clearly answer what were straightforward questions. We're all sort of tied in knots about what can and can't be said, policing ourselves through ideologies that we may or may not agree with, that the self-censorship of the last 15 years has been it's equally high as the self-censorship that's now in place because of external pressures. I'm saying in the pre-talk, some pretty good work on this. Of course, people will disagree, but this era is actually worse than the McCarthy period in terms of self-reported self-censorship on the part of professors, and then the number of professors put under duress of one kind or another by both internal and external factors. Russ Duhout in the New York Times has summed up the difference between persecuting us between the right and the left. A faction of the left wants to do it through cultural norms. We will persecute ourselves back and forth. The right tends to want to do it mostly through legislation. Or in this case, executive order. Right. So what's happening in a place like Texas, for example, Texas A&M, which some of you may have read about, is you've got the worst of both worlds coming together. You've got a piece of leftist ideology in terms of what can and can't be said, the control of the language, right, with a kind of right ideology or a faction of the right ideology around which particular ideologies, especially patriotism, should can be taught. So you've got an anti-racist, anti-gender discrimination law on the books, which on the face of it, ironically, both sides have fostered, both sides would agree to that point, right? Yes, the left, parts of the left say we should be racist, you know, anti-racist, and we should have gender equity and equality. The right says, yes, we should have those things, and guess what? They interpret them tremendously differently, so you get this absurdity that we're faced with, and the professors at Texas A&M are faced with, in which parts of Plato, in which Plato, the various members of the Greek philosophical community are talking about the origins of love, and there's a reference there to a third gender. Okay, this is Greek history. Maybe apocryphal, may not be, who knows, but the folks at Texas A&M are like, ah, we got it, flag it, get it out. And before we cast too much of a stone in their direction, just remember that factions of the left have been doing exactly the same thing now for the last decade and a half. This is where animosity and AI come together, though, because guess who's going through? The Texas A&M professors have to submit their syllabi for evaluation. Guess who's doing the evaluation? An AI program. So everything's been done by AI first, and then it gets to some president or vice president or who knows who, making $300,000 a year, knowing who knows what, doing who knows what. You know, don't get me started on that one. And some poor philosophy professors in the 60s have been teaching the Symposium, one of the great works of Western philosophy, has all of a sudden said excerpts of that have to go. What he's done in his particular case is filled up that week where they would be talking about that part of the symposium with a handful of articles that have been written on censorship and academic freedom and the ways in which the media has been handling this particular outrage. Academic freedom, just as a reminder, refers to the ability of teachers, students, and educational institutions to pursue knowledge without unreasonable political or government interference. That's the whole of it. And then you get endless court cases and endless statements one way or the other about what academic freedom is. The most consequential Supreme Court case, 1957, Sweezy versus New Hampshire, McCarthy period. Avowedly Marxist professor gives a Marxist lecture, is, you know, come down on like a ton of bricks, and goes all the way to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court very powerfully states, look, academic freedom is absolutely crucial. It is the foundational, crucial move for anything like the pursuit of truth and knowledge. Said, and in a democracy, you know, what's more important than truth and knowledge? Not just for science, but for every endeavor of human imagination and action. The unfettered ability to figure out, find out what's true, and act on it, or repel it if it must be repelled. Right? What's a university for, fundamentally, finally? That particular activity. How much interference should we have in that? Very, very little. Why? Because we're the people who've been vetted and get tenure by our peers to pursue that. Have we done that responsibly? Always no. All right. And if there's a course correction, that will come. It should come internally. It didn't. So we now find ourselves in this state where, sure, you can say and do whatever you want, DeWild. We'll just pull all federal funding from Grand Valley. You know. And we are on the list. I was surprised to see it about a month after the Trump administration came in. I was expecting the Harvards of the world to take their hit. They have. I'm a little proud of Harvard because of my connection to it and the ways in which they actually, unlike places like Northwestern, have stood up to it and are fighting the good fight, or at least what I consider to be that. But Grand Valley was on the list too. So that's one form of notoriety, I guess. Maybe it means we're playing in the big leagues. That's good. One little pitch for Grand Valley, though, by the way, especially with Tory here, and this is not a recruitment device, but what I just said makes me think of it. However you think of Grand Valley, one of the things you should know about it is that our students who are in the 5, 6, 7 top percent of students in Grand Valley not only would do well anywhere, but they are doing well anywhere. They are going to places like the Harvards, the Yales, the Oxfords, Cambridge. I've had any number of students go to U of M Law School. If you're at all wondering, can you get there from here? With Grand Valley being here, the question is yes, and they're proving that on a regular basis. So just that as an aside. Final one before I turn it over to Tori. What am I looking at? Oh, man, that's not enough time. we'll talk a little bit about, and I think she will echo this and maybe talk about it from a student perspective in ways that I can't, and that is I have long thought two things should happen in higher education, and you'll be dismayed to hear this. Nobody in a position of power has asked me to be the education czar for the United States of America yet, which is a huge blind spot as far as I can tell. Two things. One, we kind of touched on a little bit this morning in pre-talk. There absolutely should be a national service component. If we're not going to do it in high school, whether you take a year between high school and college, or you take that first year of college, second year, I don't know. There are details to be worked out. I can't have all the answers. But the fact that we don't still promote some kind of national service endeavor and really, in fact, require everybody to do it has been one of the factors that's undermined our civic life and the civic virtue. The fact that we don't teach civics anymore is also a problem, and I think we should. That's a separate issue. But one, some kind of national service program in which everybody has to kind of rub shoulders. One of the elements that's pointed to post-World War II for how civic-minded we were, how compressed the gap between the highest wages and lowest wages. Not that there weren't lots and lots of problems in the 50s and 60s, of course, but people were coming out of World War II having rubbed shoulders with folks they'd never met before. There was a greater sense of civic engagement. I don't think anybody argues terribly with that. That's one. The other one for me, which is more controversial, and I get killed at conferences on this on a regular basis, is that we should be much better trained to engage in what I call affective education. We still teach, after all this time, to people's heads, as if the rest of them didn't exist, as if we haven't learned from the last 30 years just how important an emotional life, emotional growth, emotional input into one's intellectual life is. And so maybe because I've become kind of more grandfatherly looking or more avuncular or clearly a lot less threatening in some way, I don't know. But it's not unusual because of the nature of the things that I teach for people to stay after class and say, oh, by the way, yeah, I was abused, I was this, and just want to talk to me about everything and everything that has nothing to do with stuff from the neck up that we spend so much time. And we have actually a hard time finding professors for the MBA program because you have to be able to think on your feet. You have to be able to respond to what people are telling you. And that's not the way we're trained. We got stuff, and you need to learn this stuff. And this back and forth and treating you as a whole person is not something we do well. Especially important right now because, is it true, you might ask, are the levels of anxiety, depression, the kind of mental health issues that we hear about, that Jonathan Haidt writes about in The Anxious Generation, between the ages of 14 and 24, is it really that bad? Yeah, I think it really is that bad. And while that generation is to be commended for being much more willing to come forward, talk about it, seek help, certainly be diagnosed and all of that, it's obviously not great that they're suffering through all this in the first place. There are lots of reasons given for that. We can talk about that more in maybe 5 minutes or so, at which time I'll also recommend these books to you because I don't want you to leave here without them. Sorry. And then I'll come on up. And then if you do have questions, we'll come back up and spend maybe 10 minutes.
Well, hello, everybody. thank you, Dr. DeWild, for having me. I'm really excited to talk to you a little bit about my college experience so far. As he said, my name is Tori. I'm a senior at Grand Valley, and I'm going to be graduating at the end of this next semester. So I have about 3 years of experience to talk to you about. First, I'm going to talk a little bit about student anxieties that I've seen in my time, a little bit about how AI has changed my experience throughout my undergrad, and then finally just some future outlook and what I hope and what I think. So starting out with the student anxieties, I've found, and we kind of talked about this a little bit in the pre-session, that students are less likely nowadays to raise their hand and speak up in class. Even in these discussion-based classes, students are having a hard time putting themselves out there and speaking up in front of everyone. And a lot of my professors have talked about this too, that they find it difficult to engage their students in that way, and it's an anxiety of potentially being wrong or going back to that cancel culture of being more morally wrong because it's difficult to be frowned upon by your peers and be on the outside because of something that you slipped up on and said in class. And that kind of brings me into AI a little bit. So it's true that in our classroom we are seeing AI so much more this past year and the year prior than in my freshman and sophomore year. And this change, while it feels really big, it probably will be even bigger for the next generation of students coming through college. And students are using it to write their essays. They're using it to do their homework. And the question is, are these students doing it because they are quote unquote lazy? Or is it because they want to do well and they want to get those A's? Because AI can do that for you, it's true. And that kind of gives some issues for my professors and the material that they're going to give us because now in my senior year, the past 2 years, I haven't written an essay in any of my classes. And I don't know if that's truly because my professors don't want to give us essays or if it's because they don't want to read AI essays. Because my freshman and sophomore year, I was writing essays. And I've started to feel like there's a little bit of a gap there with my knowledge. And especially going into grad school, I want to feel like I am capable in writing and have those resources without AI necessarily. So then looking to the future, that does bring up some issues for me as a student and knowing how to navigate. If you were to ask me what my general outlook is, I would say it really depends on the day that you ask me. It's hard to say. And this kind of bleak outlook, I couldn't tell you if it's because AI is ever changing and I don't know what I'm going to see, or if it's because right now in my life, I'm kind of standing at the edge of a cliff, getting ready to leave my undergrad, and I can't see my future super clearly. Either way, I have kind of been inspired in this past year in that in almost all of my classes, my professors have told me, this is my favorite class to teach, or I'm so excited to be here with you and give you this material. And it just has kind of reminded me that there are people who really care about educating, and there are students who really care about learning. A lot of my friends, a lot of my peers are going on to graduate studies because they do really care about their education and they want to learn more, as well as they do their work in class because they want to learn. So it's just kind of reminded me that there's people out there who want to do the research on this. They want to see how can we have education and AI at the same time. And they're going to keep researching until we find a place where we can sit and educate and learn and still use AI as a resource. So I think I'm probably pretty close to my 5 minutes now. So I hope that I can leave you with that lasting thought of people still care and I still care, and that's why I'm continuing on in my education.
Did I get applause? I don't remember. That's all right, no problem. We're all such good friends, it doesn't really matter to me. So, response to Tori, then we'll open it up for just 5 minutes or whatever the powers that be here tell us we can do. And that is there is a movement among serious academics to let go of long-form essays altogether. And really any kind of serious writing. George Burnett, the historian at Princeton, probably is the most vocal on this. We should just use AI in our digital age as the kind of touchstones now for what education is going to look for going forward. Asking people to read long essays, asking them to write long essays, that becomes relegated to what he calls the literate age, and we're entering a post-literate digital literacy age. And so I think people like Tori are right to be concerned. A lot of pushback on that, as you can imagine, but still, what do we lose when we lose the long-form essay is a burning question. Leslie.
What about oral discussions as in place of essays where there's class time answering questions orally and more dialogue that is in place of essay, written essays?
Definitely.
The question is there becoming more emphasis on oral presentations, interactivity, conversation, discussion within the classroom as a way of replacing that kind of writing?
I think definitely there has been some movement towards that. There's also been movement, at least in my classes, towards the standard sit-in-class pen-paper test, which is not really lovely for anyone, I don't think. As somebody who's going into graduate school, hopes to eventually come back to academia as a professor, I think that really is kind of where we see the future going, that in order to understand what people really have been learning and have them connect those dots in a way that they could previously do in an essay, discussion is where things might end up lying. And I do have some professors, now that I'm in higher course levels, that prefer that to anything else, and they grade us on discussion opposed to writing or tests or things like that.
I am doing the same. Wait.
What you're talking about the singularity? Can you help us understand that and how these questions are related to that?
Can you say more about what you mean by that? Yes. Yes, that's right. Do you? I'll take that unless you have a comment.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So. So that's been first science fiction and now in science, this notion that we will be merged with technology. It'll be difficult, and who knows whether that's going to be better or worse. But I think for a group like this, it's going to be interesting because all that question, the question that you oftentimes entertain yourselves with here, what it means to be human. It's like, whoa, we're just at the beginning of that once that starts. Suleiman is one of my authorities on this. He's genuinely quite concerned about that. A, he thinks it's a real possibility. B, he thinks it's, you know, one bad actor upsets that entire prospect. And so, yes, there is a lot of talk in now grounded in actual science. And I want to be succinct myself. Here's what that makes me think of, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this now. If you ever want me to come back, or maybe somebody here knows more about this than I do, there is something now being developed at Johns Hopkins called organoid intelligence. If you haven't come across it, Google it. Guy's really nice. I've met him, pleasant as can be. It really is a brain in a petri dish idea hooked up to supercomputers where we can replicate. What his thing is, AI takes way too much energy, still takes too much time, and it can't replicate the brain in full. Let's grow some brains. Let's hook them up to supercomputers and AI and skip this whole AI phase altogether. If that doesn't make you want to do some Googling, let me know. How is AI not plagiarism?
Well, I think
Tori will now settle this for all time.
I think that there's definitely a lot of debate still about what is plagiarism. At what point does AI become not your own work? Especially, all my professors are calling it the Wild West when they talk about it in their classes. They say, we don't really know, but this is my rule. And I think Grand Valley has done some policies on that recently. But I think that at least when I was applying to all of like my grad school applications, if I wrote my own work and then used AI as an editing tool, it said that was not plagiarism. That is totally valid. And they were actually suggesting that we do that because it's a great editing tool. And I mean, with that being said, there's obviously the AI that can actually control your mouse and use it to answer quiz questions for you, and that's obviously not your own work in any way. But also, I know a lot of people who use it for studying, so they can plug all of their material into a device called Notebook LM, and it'll give them answers and study materials. It can make flashcards for them and so on and so forth. So there's definitely a lot of power that it has to help you as a student. And as far as I've heard from all of my professors, it's okay to use it in that way, and they actually suggest that we use it in that way because it's a good teacher outside of going to their office hours. But yeah, if you are prompting it with the questions that you're receiving for a quiz, then that's not really okay with anyone, I don't think.
Still a lot of confusion about that, sorting that out because it's so new. But my favorite story so far, if I haven't told it before, is a group of students in the class were found to be had used AI, handed in an AI essay, got caught, and they used AI to write their apology. No. Do we have a few? Are we okay?
Yeah. I have a concern in my grandchildren's relationship with their cell phone. What will a chip do? You cannot control it really, but what will a chip do?
Well,
who will control that?
The rhetoric will be that your own brain can control that, but rather that, so here's the functional aspect that they're trying to sell us on, which is, okay, everything that I'm thinking right now, I have a question in my head, I've got a class coming up, somebody asked me a question about Nietzsche, I forgot to look it up. All I have to do is think about it, and the chip will go out and get it the way we would now use Google or other tools to do that and download it into the right parts of my brain so I have access to it. So as one thinks, so shall one become, as Shakespeare probably sort of said. Well, that, of course, is the ethical dilemma in which you're going to have a few tech bros at the center of the machine. In all of this, if you have not seen the movie with the Latin title, where the one where the woman takes over, Ex Machina, or Her, or any of those, and again, there are these two books. The other book, it's long, AI, The Empire of AI, by Karen Howe, who again grew up, went to school with all these guys, has a lot of access to their world, and has written a long book about just how terrifying the answer to that question in their minds is.
Michael, one
yes. Okay. Last one. Can you say just a little bit more?
Like, do you have writing 101? Are you going to have, like, information literacy 101 or digital literacy 101?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the short answer to that question is yes. I'd love to tell you it doesn't matter who's teaching that. I think it does. I don't know if you want to say anything.
I don't know.
Okay. Thank you. If you want to stay for talkback, that happens in...
After snacks.
Right, I'm not supposed to announce it. There's supposed to be somebody who does that. There's a new term called auto exploitation. I feel like that's what I just did.